Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, our first one for this new year of 2022, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Leading Heartland. Laura, here we are again in our second year, and it is great to be with you in January on this night.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year indeed, and boy, do we have lots to talk about, including what we can expect in this new year, and we're going to get to that a little bit later in this broadcast, but we're going to start this program the way we have so often in the past, with a coronavirus onslaught around Iowa and the nation. Today, the Iowa Department of Health, on Monday, reported a sharp spike in positive coronavirus cases in the state. Last week, 17,773 positive cases in the past 7 days, way up from Friday's report of 13,000, it's a 37% hike. The state's 14-day positivity rate is now 15.5%. Laura, this is very bad news to start out this new year.
Yes, it is. And as we've discussed before, I tend to focus on the hospitalization numbers more than the case numbers. And I do think it's possible that these very high case numbers may be related to some delayed reporting with the Christmas holiday. But still, by any standard, I mean, 17,000 new cases, very high. And that positivity rate just tells us that we're not testing enough people. There are many, many more infections out there that we're not discovering. And what I was most worried about was that the hospitalizations went up today from 711 on a Friday to 768. So they were dropping down for part of December. The hospitalizations were exceeding the 800 level, and they had dropped back down a little bit over the break, and now they're back up. And about 80% of those people who are in the hospital are not vaccinated. So it's a very worrying trend.
And you wonder what it's going to take. And perhaps the answer is nothing to get those folks who are not vaccinated to take the shot. These people, apparently, from everything we know, are often Trump supporters. They are Republicans. They will refuse to get the vaccinations. So it doesn't matter if they're hospitalized, if they die. Apparently, they just don't want to get vaccinated.
Yeah, and I mean, it's very sad. I've talked to some people who have lost family members recently who were unvaccinated, and they don't. I mean, the portions of their family who are unvaccinated did not go out and get a vaccine, even after watching a loved one pass away. So it's very sad. I will say that I do know quite a lot of fully vaccinated and boosted people who have tested positive in the last week or two. This new variant is just so highly transmissible. So even people who are diligent about masking when in public, it's just very high. And one of my friends posted today on Twitter that she, unbeknownst to them, her child was carrying the virus. They went to a Christmas holiday gathering, and now 12 of the 16 people who were there at this Christmas gathering are either symptomatic or have already tested positive. And this is a family where everybody was vaccinated.
Wow. There was also word last week, and this number is undoubtedly outdated by now, but the last official word was that 41 people had been confirmed to have the Omicron variant of the virus in 12 of Iowa's most populous counties, including Story. That is undoubtedly different today, but this is the last official word. The variant is spreading so fast, I'm sure, and you are too. It's over much of Iowa now.
Yes, I think everyone should just assume that it's in their area. And we also don't know the people who are getting the home tests. That's not being analyzed by the state hygienic lab. So it's very likely to be quite prevalent. I mean, it does seem to be outcompeting the Delta variant in most of the country.
The good news is that apparently it is less virulent. It is spreading faster, but is less virulent. And that could mean, if you want to take a positive look at this, and let's do that, that more people will get it, and therefore more people will become immune, or at least have a stronger defense against future viruses here.
Yes, I've been reading a little bit about this, and there's still a lot that they need to discover about the Omicron variant, but it does seem to confer pretty good immunity even against the Delta variant. And the combination of being vaccinated but also having tested positive, it seems to be very promising. Also, in places where the Omicron variant hit harder before it reached Iowa, they've seen the sharp rise in cases led to an increase in hospitalizations, but not as sharp an increase. So they're hoping that that means that, it, as you say, that it is less virulent. Of course, it's still very dangerous, especially for people who are immunocompromised. And so it is important to keep the community transmission lower if we can do that.
Still on the coronavirus beat, the U.S. District Court of Appeals ruled last week that Tyson Foods, a very big player in Iowa, was not operating under the direction of the federal government and operating the way it did at the start of the coronavirus pandemic. This is all part of a lawsuit being filed by families of four workers at Tyson's Waterloo Pork Processing Facility who died after getting the coronavirus. So this was an interesting decision.
Yeah, so these are families of people who died in April or May of 2020, so very early on in the pandemic. And as you'll recall, there were huge outbreaks at the large meatpacking plants all around Iowa. And one of the first to be hit was the Tyson plant in Columbus Junction down in southeast Iowa. And there were reports at the time in April of 2020 that after Tyson temporarily closed that Columbus Junction plant, they just bussed people right up to Waterloo to work alongside people in the Waterloo plant, and they didn't have adequate PPE. And that's the basis for this lawsuit, that people were being required to work, that management wasn't making sure that they had the proper social distancing or PPE protections. And Tyson was trying to get this case heard in federal court because that would be a more favorable venue for them. But the appeals court, this was a three-judge panel from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a pretty conservative circuit overall. And they said, no, that just because the federal government had declared that the meatpacking industry was an essential industry, that didn't mean that they were directing the activities. Tyson and other companies retain the ability to make decisions, management decisions, such as temporarily closing plants. And the designation of essential was more about Tyson and other companies getting assistance from the federal government rather than direction from the federal government. That was what the appeals court held. So what all of that means is that then these plaintiffs can now have their day in court in Iowa, which is where they originally filed the suit in the Iowa District Court.
And we should also, pardon me, we should also say that Tyson mandated after all of this that their employees get vaccinated. And the last word I had heard was that well more than 90% of Tyson workers around the state had been vaccinated.
Yes. I mean, ironically, one of the counties in this November, December period, one of the counties in Iowa that had the lowest number of new cases was Buena Vista County, where there's a massive Tyson facility and a couple of other food processing facilities in the Storm Lake area. And Buena Vista had very high case numbers in 2020, the highest in Iowa on a per capita basis. But the combination of some infection acquired immunity and also Tyson's vaccine mandate, of course, they are by far the dominant employer in that area, that has really helped keep the new cases lower compared to a lot of other counties during this latest wave.
Also word last week about something you had reported on last month, and the other folks are just catching up with you, that Iowa is expected to spend more than $9 million to place 100 out-of-state nurses and respiratory therapists in the state's bigger healthcare facilities for 6 weeks to try to fight off the problems of being overcrowded in those facilities. Now, the state has agreed to pay a Kansas company a lot of money for the nurses it supplies and a lot of money to the nurses themselves. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so Jared Strong of Iowa Capital Dispatch followed up on this reporting, and he was able to get some details on the contract from the Iowa Department of Public Health. So this is going to be federal dollars from some COVID-19 federal pool of relief money. That this is for the 100 traveling nurses and respiratory therapists that are going to be or have already been assigned to the 17 largest medical centers around the state of Iowa. And the state agency says that this isn't only going to help those 17 hospitals, but it should also help the smaller rural hospitals because it'll allow them to transfer more patients to the major medical centers because it'll free up and allow more ICU beds in those major hospitals to be staffed. So we already knew from my reporting last month that the nurses were going to be paid very high rates between $110 and $130 an hour for their regular pay. And then time and a half for overtime. They were expected to work 60-hour weeks during this six-week contract. And Jared Strong got details about the contract. So the Kansas-based company, which is placing the nurses, they're going to be paid an even higher rate of at least $220 per nurse. So it's going to be very expensive. But again, it's federal dollars paying for it. One thing that has caused some friction, I've heard from some nurses in Iowa, they're frustrated that Iowa-based nurses were not allowed to apply to be in this contract. They didn't want to incentivize people quitting their staff positions in Iowa to work for higher pay. This hourly pay that these traveling nurses are going to receive is, in some cases, four times as much as what the regular nurses staffing those hospitals are getting. So in that sense, it's not great for the morale in the regular hospitals. But I should mention that Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames is one of the ones that is receiving four staff, a combination of nurses and respiratory therapists through this contract.
Yeah, and the nurses may be making more than $15,000 a week for those 6 weeks. And I'll see you in our nursing class at the community college tomorrow night, Laura.
Right. Right. Yes. I mean, the company is getting at least $15,000 a week, and the nurses may be clearing, let's say, 9,000 to 10,000 of that. It's quite a lot. And they're also getting lodging. They're getting a hotel and some kind of transportation stipend on top of that.
One more coronavirus related note, indirectly related. District court judge ruled that a wrongful termination suit against Iowa Governor Reynolds could continue. Now, this involves former State Department of Public Health spokesperson Polly Carver Kim. She was fired, and she alleges that she was terminated because she was getting too responsive to the news media in fulfilling open records requests, some of them involving the coronavirus. So this is a wild case here. What do you make of this?
So Polly Carver Kim was the communications director for the State Department of Public Health for about 13 years. And then she lost her job a few months into the pandemic. Right away, they started removing duties from her and they put somebody else in charge of responding to COVID-19 related requests. And she, in her lawsuit, she alleges that she was blocked in several ways from providing information to members of the media. So this stage, the court ruling that recently came down right before Christmas, this is a very early stage. This was, the state was trying to have the lawsuit dismissed. So this judge wasn't deciding the merits of her termination suit. He was just deciding whether it can continue or whether the state can get this thing tossed out. And basically the state's arguments were just comprehensively rejected. So she can proceed. She can have her day in district court. And what was most important from the media perspective for transparency advocates in Iowa, we've all been watching this very closely because one of the state's arguments in this motion to dismiss was that the open records law was not a so-called well-defined public policy that can serve as the basis for a wrongful termination suit. And so she was saying she was fired because she properly provided records as the law requires. And if the state had prevailed on this motion, you can easily see how that could have led to any number of government agencies at the state or local level just telling their records custodians, you're not going to provide any more records to anybody or else you're going to be fired. So that was very important. The judge said that this is a well-recognized public policy. It's an important public policy for the well-being of Iowans, and it can serve as the basis for a wrongful termination lawsuit. Now, that doesn't mean that she's going to be able to convince a jury that she was fired for that reason, but it does mean that she can make those arguments in court.
Right. All right. It's 13 minutes after the hour, wherever you are listening to us on this Monday night. And you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart, along with Laura Bell, and we are here every week at this time to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Let's put on our crystal ball gazing hats now. And I've got my crystal ball in front of me and my hat, a very stylish hat on right now. Let's look ahead at what we can expect. The state legislative session begins, reconvenes next Monday, this coming Monday, next week. So there are a number of things we're going to be watching out for throughout this program this year. So many things to talk about, so many things we're going to get involved with. Among them, can Democrats field strong enough candidates against Governor Reynolds and Senator Grassley? And how competitive will the state's congressional races be this year? Let's start with the governor's race. Laura, what do you see there coming up? We know that the polls show that Governor Reynolds is in a strong position.
Yes, I mean, right now, her approval rating is a little above 50%. That's usually where incumbents want to be. I mean, of course, they'd like to be higher than that, but she is not in that danger zone of below 50%. And the two declared candidates, Deidre DeGeer and Roz Smith, are not very well known. So I haven't seen a lot of head-to-head polling, but they're at a big disadvantage because they would have to spend a lot of money just to get their name recognition up to a certain level. And the candidates are going to be reporting fundraising here on by January 19th is their deadline. But it's expected that Governor Reynolds probably raised millions of dollars last year. We'll see when the reports are filed in. So that is an advantage that she's definitely going to take into the campaign.
So our early handicapping is she's the favorite right now.
Yes, I mean, likely Republican. I think one of the forecasters even has it ranked solid Republican, but I think a likely Republican hold, especially given that a midterm election tends to be good for the party that's not in power in Washington. And this year, that's the Republican Party.
Okay, what chance do you think the Democrats have against Senator Grassley, longtime Republican incumbent going for another term, though he is in his upper 80s? He is, again, having some good poll numbers as we go into this year. What do you see in that race?
I mean, his poll numbers are mixed. The only head-to-head poll that I've seen, he was 18 points ahead of Abby Finkenauer, who's the front runner for the Democratic nomination. So that is certainly encouraging for Republicans. Chuck Grassley's approval rating right now is below 50%. That is, it's the lowest point that it's been since the early 1980s in the Des Moines Register polling. I mean, when I started writing my blog in the 2000s, Grassley's approval rating was often in the high 60s, sometimes over 70%. So it's really declined a lot. The polarization of the last decade has seen his approval rating steadily erode. And so he's not in the same commanding position that he would have been a few cycles ago. But I definitely, you have to say that Grassley is the strong favorite. And most of the forecasters say that as long as Grassley is the nominee, this should be a safe Republican seat. I mean, I would, maybe you could convince me that it's a likely Republican seat rather than a safe Republican seat, but it's definitely going to be an uphill battle for the Democratic nominee.
Let's talk about the congressional races very quickly here. The first congressional district, that race is now listed as likely Republican by three political gurus, the Cook Political Report, Larry Salvado's Crystal Ball, and Inside Elections with Nathan Gonzalez. You reported on this last week on Bleeding Heartland. So number one, that new first congressional district, Marionette Miller Meeks, the incumbent. She's now District 2, but because of redistricting, going to run as District 1. Do you agree with that, that the race is likely Republican?
I think that I could argue that it's lean Republican rather than likely Republican. I will say that these forecasters often have access to internal polling by the parties that is not publicly available. I think that there's a combination. The district itself doesn't lean extremely to the Republicans. It's about the partisan voting index is an R+3, which means that it votes about 3 points more Republican than the country as a whole. But I think that they're looking at the overall environment, the fact that it's likely to be a good election year for Republicans, the combination of that plus the incumbency factor, it definitely favors Marionette Miller Meeks. So, I mean, I think you could argue about whether it's likely Republican or lean Republican. They've all landed on the likely Republican side.
The new second congressional district, again, not trying to confuse people. It's the old first district largely, but the forecasters disagree. The incumbent is Republican Ashley Hinson, who's likely going to face Democrat Liz Matthes. Inside Elections and Sabato both see this as likely Republican, while Cook puts it in the solid Republican category. What do you think?
Yeah, I just don't agree with that. I mean, this has a partisan voting index of R+4. So it means, again, that the residents of those counties vote about 4 points more Republican than the country as a whole. And Ashley Hinson is an incumbent. But I just, on principle, I would not put an R+4 district in the safe Republican column. The safe Republican districts tend to be overwhelmingly Republican in terms of an advantage in voter registration and voting behavior, and or they have a very long-serving entrenched incumbent. Ashley Hinson is in her first term. So the Democrats have a strong candidate in State Senator Liz Matthes. And so I see this as either a lean Republican or a likely Republican seat. I definitely would not take it off the table and say that it's uncompetitive.
Okay. The third congressional district, that is going to be a wild one. The incumbent is Democrat Cindy Axne. Forecasters rate this as a toss-up. The likely opponent is Republican Zach Nunn. This is going to be an absolutely wild and expensive race.
Yes, and I think it speaks to the strengths of Cindy Axne as a candidate that all of these forecasters, despite seeing Iowa as very strong Republican territory right now, and this district also is about an R+3. I mean, it does lean slightly to the Republicans in terms of voting behavior, but Cindy Axne has won under tough conditions a couple of times, and they see this as a the fact that they are calling this a toss-up and not a lean Republican race, I think, says that they expect her to outperform the top of the Democratic ticket. And I think that's fair. I mean, the Polk and Dallas County are the vast majority of residents of this district. The new counties in the south of Iowa, they lean strongly Republican. But I think Cindy Axne's chances really depend on how well can she do in the suburbs of Des Moines. Can the likely Republican nominee, Zach Nunn, can he do a little bit better in the suburbs than David Young did in the last two elections?
This is going to be a very expensive race.
Yes, millions of dollars are likely to be spent. Again, we're going to see the fourth quarter fundraising for the candidates, those reports aren't due until the end of January. But in these competitive U.S. House races anymore, what the candidates spend is usually eclipsed by what outside groups spend. So like the National Republican Congressional Committee, or on the Democratic side, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, they often end up spending three or four times what the candidates themselves raised and spent. But Cindy Axne has raised a lot of money, quite a lot more than Zach Nunn to date. We'll see. He should have a stronger fourth quarter because he did get the official backing of the National Republican Congressional Committee in October. So that should help his fundraising a little bit, but he'll be at a slight disadvantage on that front.
And then there's the fourth congressional district, the one that Story County and Ames are in. This one is probably going to be a yawner. The incumbent is Republican Randy Feenstra. All forecasters agree he's a safe reelection bet, and barring some unforeseen circumstance, this isn't going to be very competitive, is it?
Yes, I'm just not hearing about any other candidates looking at this. I'm not hearing about any Democrats looking at it. There were rumors that maybe some Republican would challenge Randy Feenstra, but I think that would be very difficult to pull off. I saw Steve King recently said it didn't sound like he was looking at a comeback, and I don't think he would probably win a primary. The only way a district this strong, this is an R plus 16 district, so 16 points more Republican than the country as a whole. So the only way a Democrat would even have any kind of a chance is if the Republican nominee had some huge, was a huge drag on the ticket in the way that Steve King was. Remember that Steve King almost lost. He only won re-election in 2018 by about 3 points. And that was a district that he should have been carrying by 20 points.
Right. Another thing we're going to be watching very closely week by week here is what issue, as the state legislature reconvenes, what issue will Republicans focus on this year? They control both houses. They can pass almost anything. The Des Moines Register is reporting that a group of state House members has committed to continuing the fight against vaccine requirements when the legislature reconvenes next week. So this is very interesting because there are also groups that oppose vaccine mandates who weren't satisfied with the action the state took last fall. And these two may be colliding next week and in weeks after.
Well, I always like a good lobbying story, and I think this is going to be the best lobbying story of the 2022 legislative session, because what we're seeing is the conservative groups, the more, I would say, Trumpian wing of the Republican Party that's very against the vaccines, and versus the business lobby, which has been the mainstay of the Republican Party. I mean, traditionally over the years, what the Republican leadership in the legislature has done has tracked pretty closely with what the large business groups want, like the Association of Business and Industry, for instance. And they do not want any further regulation of what businesses can require of their employees. They didn't like this, the limited bill on the vaccine mandates in October. They didn't like that, but they were not able to keep that one at bay. And what they did preserve was employers' right to require vaccines, but it was full of all kinds of loopholes because the employers are required to accept the various exemptions, and the employee doesn't have to show any kind of medical need or a religious belief, just has to state a health reason or a religious reason. So we're going to see. I mean, there's a group of Republican lawmakers who want to entirely ban employers, but that's a slippery slope. I think there are a lot of people in those Republican caucuses who aren't going to be comfortable with telling business owners what they can and can't require. That's just ideologically not a place where the Republican Party has been over the years. So I'm very interested. I always love these strange bedfellow stories, and we're just going to see how this plays out in the legislative session.
So apparently Republican leaders in the state, they are very obviously high on what's happened in the last few years, and they should be. The GOP has turned the state into a far more conservative direction on issues such as tax cuts, limiting employees, collective bargaining rights, all these things. And apparently this year, they're going to make a push, at least some are, to kill the state income tax. Do you think they're going to have any success in that?
No, I think there will be some kind of a large tax cut. That's clearly on the table. There's a budget surplus, and whenever there's a budget surplus, the Republicans like to pass a big tax cut. I don't think that they can get away with entirely eliminating the income tax. It just, the math doesn't add up. Almost half the state revenue comes from the income tax. And I even to put Iowa on the road toward eliminating it, it just isn't very likely, because this budget surplus is largely due to the federal assistance during the pandemic, and that has an expiration date on it. So I think what's going to happen is we'll see a lot of backroom jockeying between the Iowa Senate and the Iowa House. We talked about this in the spring. The Iowa Senate Republicans tend to be a little more aggressive in the tax cuts that they want. And the Iowa House Republicans, who are the appropriators and the Ways and Means Committee people, they are a little bit more cautious. And I think we're going to see that. But everybody's going to make sure that there is some kind of a big tax cut because Governor Reynolds wants that. She wants to sign that. She wants to campaign on that. And so I expect some kind of a tax cut, and it may include an income tax reduction of some kind. But I don't see eliminating the income tax as viable at all. I mean, the sales tax would have to be increased substantially.
Democrats are saying that Republicans are not addressing problems like Iowa's declining public education rankings, their workforce challenges, struggling mental health care system, lack of child care access, but they virtually have no power in the state. Can they get any traction on any of this?
Not really. I mean, just they can just get attention and try to make that argument. I mean, the one thing about mainstream media reporting is that usually they do try to present some perspective from the other side. So the best that Democrats can do is stand up while these bills are being debated and say that this isn't the right path. This isn't going to address the problems. I mean, it is true that the workforce shortage, I mean, there have been several tax cuts and those haven't resolved the workforce shortage and the issues with education. I should say that there probably will be a big push on education-related bills, whether it's a voucher-type program to pull money into private schools or something. The Senate President Jake Chapman wants to work on something that would allow, that would ban certain types of books from public school libraries. So I do expect that that issue is going to get quite a bit of oxygen. I don't know how far he's going to get with that, but it'll probably be something that is debated in a high-profile way.
Another issue that you and I are going to be looking at with a magnifying glass, will the National Democrats kill the Iowa caucuses in 2024? We know that the Democrats could not count the votes for a long time after the Iowa caucuses last year. Have National Democrats had enough?
Well, the issue has been brewing for a long time, more than a decade, that Iowa and New Hampshire are among the least racially diverse states in the country, like in the bottom six in terms of diversity. And so there are a lot of Democrats around the United States who just feel that it's wrong to start the nominating process in states that are so overwhelmingly white. And I expected that they would get a lot of traction after 2020. I was interested to see the Democratic National Committee just had a big winter meeting, and the reporting that came out of that from Politico and some other sources, but primarily Politico had the most detailed report. It said that it's not likely that they're going to change the calendar before 2024. Partly the party just has other things to worry about right now. There's a lot of focus on trying to get the Build Back Better bill passed, trying to get some traction behind voting rights legislation. And since President Joe Biden is assumed to be running for re-election in 2024, the first primaries and caucuses are not going to be as important. So what some of the delegates were saying is that probably the calendar is going to remain in place for 2024 when Democrats don't have a real contest. But going into 2028, the role of the Iowa caucuses is likely to be substantially reduced. So that could happen in a number of ways. I mean, it could be that the caucuses are moved to a later date, or it could be that they happen early, but the Democratic National Committee imposes some kind of sanctions, like saying that our delegates count for less, or discouraging presidential candidates from spending a lot of time campaigning here in some other way. So we'll just see. So I expect that by 2028, we probably won't have the same influence, but it looks like in 2024, at least for those off your caucuses, when it's going to be competitive on the Republican side, but probably not on the Democratic side, that calendar may not change after all.
30 seconds left. Legislature reconvenes next Monday. What do you look for on the first day of a legislative session?
I listen to what the leadership says. Usually they set the tone. I always look to see whether they talk about social issues. Usually they don't highlight social issues. I'm looking to see whether they say anything about abortion restrictions on that opening day.
This is going to be a wild year because of all the elections going on. You've covered politics now for a whole lot of years, though you're not very old. Are you excited about this coming year?
I am excited. I mean, it's always when a legislative session is beginning, it is always a pretty energizing time for me.
And I can tell by the look on your face, you're getting excited already. Hey, Laura, thank you. It's been a pleasure again, starting out another year of Capital Week with you.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
We are out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura Bellin and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week. We promise, the week the state legislature reconvenes, and we will have a lot to talk about then. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We value it. We know you have other things to do, and we thank you for being here. Between now and next time, we hope you have a great week. Between now and next week, Happy New Year.